It's a pleasure to be here today, and if I should explain the dramatic character of the title of the lecture, I would maybe remember a story that Billy Graham frequently told. Evangelists tell stories, as you remember, and Billy told a number of stories. He told one that got close to me because I'm a horse lover and have been a horse owner, and this one hurt. He's told a story about a farmer who wanted to buy a mule. And he went over to his neighbor who had mules to sell, and he struck a bargain for a mule, which he took home with him. And the man who sold the mule said, "You have no trouble with this animal. All you have to do is to get behind him and flick the reins and say, 'Get up,' and he's off. He'll pull the plow all day." And the buyer said, "Fine, that's what I'm looking for exactly." And so he took the mule and took him home. And the next day, promptly at daybreak, he's out with the mule, all harnessed, in front of the plow, hooked up to the plow. And behind the mule, has his reins in hands and says, "Get up." Nothing happens. Mule stood stock still. And he tried it over and over again for about an hour, and nothing happened. And finally, he said to himself, "I've been gypped here. I got to do something about this." And so he went over to the neighbor who sold him the mule and said, "What about this?" He says, I can't get the mule to budge. It doesn't do a thing. I did exactly what you told me." And so the farmer said, "That's funny. I never had any problem with it." And he said, "I'll come over and see what I can do." And so he came over to his neighbor's farm. And on his way, he picked up a tubifore. You know what a tubifore is? A piece of wood like this. And before he got behind the mule and picked up the reins, he walked up to the mule's head, took the tubifore, and hit him across the nose. And then he got back, picked up the reins, "Get up." The mule went perfectly well. Pulled the plow all day. And the farmer who bought the animal said, "Well, what's this business with the tubifore? You didn't mention the tubifore." And the farmer who sold the mule said, "Well, you do have to get his attention. And I'm trying to get your attention with the title, Church Music and Worship in Crisis." I personally believe that the crisis that we face is not just a momentary blip on the passing of history. It's not just something that will be characteristic of your generation and will pass away in the next generation. I think that what's happening is that we're having a cataclysmic change in worship and its musical expression, which may be as great a change as that which took place in the 16th century at the time of the Protestant Reformation. It may be as great a change as happened in the 19th century when revivalism became a big part of Baptist life. It may be bigger than either of those. It is a cataclysmic and perhaps permanent change. So it's worth talking about. I'm speaking in the context of the title of your course, Music in Contemporary Culture. Is that it? Worship in Contemporary Culture.
And Contemporary Culture.
Worship and Contemporary Culture. Well, that's good. It allows you lots of room. What is culture? What is culture? Well, you might say a culture is how we dress, what language we use, what movies we see, what books we read, if any, what hymns we sing, what sports we follow. Yes, culture is all of these. But culture is much more than these. I think culture, perhaps above all, is our value system, the value system of a culture, of a society. It's not that you love sports and that you're active in sports. The question is, what part does sports play in your whole life? How big a God is sports in your life? And it's not just how you worship. It's what are your objectives in worship? What is your value system? Whom are you worshiping? What are you worshiping? What do you value? Jesus said he wanted his disciples to be in the world, but not of the world. I believe that he might just as well have said, I want them to be in the culture, but not of the culture. For me, the word world means more than anything else, culture. What the world values. What it has made its God. So let me launch immediately into the material of the lecture. And in the 2 days that I have, I will try to do two things. One, I will try to set the scene for what I think is true of today's culture. I'll try to set the problem in front of us. And then on the second day, I will try to offer some suggestions as to how the church should face this culture crisis. In the last chapter of Jubilate 2, if you've read the book, you may possibly remember this. I asked the question, without really answering it, is this, meaning today, one of God's terrible springtimes? The phrase appeared in one of Billy Graham's sermons, in which he referred to the frightening buildup of nuclear armaments in the Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union. Repeat again the question, is today one of God's terrible springtimes? Terrible is a self-conscious word in that particular phrase. As best I can remember it, Billy said something like this. We seem to be living in a period just prior to Armageddon. That's the legendary battle that many Christians believe will mark the end of history. Or in one of God's terrible springtimes. Billy seemed to be saying that there are periods of history in which circumstances of life are ominously dark and foreboding. Like the bitter cold and slush of the last winter storm in our so-called temperate climate zones. And I dare say, having lived here for 35 years, watch out, it can happen in Kentucky in the next week or two. The last dregs of winter. But late winter may be no more than a terrible springtime. Because underneath the snow and ice, promising shoots, for instance, like the signing of a nuclear arms treaty or the political breakup of the Soviet Union, are beginning to emerge from long dormant seeds. A new greening of the landscape, like a new era of international peace and goodwill, will soon be experienced. In the worship life of our generation, the prevailing winds are those of change. In many ways, radical change, and I have said, crisis change. Old forms and practices, especially of music, are disappearing and new ones are taking their place. For some folks who call the movement contemporary and creative, full-blown present spring is already here. And the new music and worship expressions are its welcome symbols. They're having a wonderful time. For others, what is happening is frightening iconoclasm. A word meaning, for me, liturgical house cleaning or worship house cleaning. A destructive pulling up of the life-sustaining roots of our Christian worship tradition. For them, this is the dead of winter, and part of the bleakness is due to the warlike conflicts created between generations or between culture preference groups in the church. But could we be living in what is only a terrible springtime that precedes genuine spiritual revival? For instance, for the first time in my memory, non-liturgical evangelical churches, for instance, Baptists, are beginning to talk about the significance of corporate Christian worship. That's a good sign. Hopefully, the interest is sparked by something more than concern for survival and will be followed with long-range study, discussion, prayer, and action and courses at Southern Seminary. If so, we could be witnessing what is only a distressing, frightening prelude to a notable work of the Holy Spirit in our community of faith. Which is it? First of all, evidence from two cultural historians. I'm going outside the church in this instance, looking at culture from the viewpoint of people who are accustomed to write about culture and to examine it critically and analytically. In the prologue to his magnum opus, From Dawn to Decadence, it's a long title, 1500 to the present, 500 years of Western cultural life, the historian Jacques Barzun, or it would be Barzun in French, discusses what he means by present decadence. Although we may assume that he judges that at the beginning of the third millennium, Western culture is in a state of decay or deterioration. Remember the title, From Dawn, 1500 to Decadence, 2000. 1500 to the present, 500 years of Western cultural life. Decay or deterioration are the dictionary synonyms of decadence. Apparently, he is not anticipating an imminent Armageddon on either a political or an eschatological, that's a religious level. And I'm going to ask you today to read through this material, because it's not my own, to read through it with me and to understand it as best you can. This is found in the prelude to his book. This would be the introduction. It's not actually part of the argument himself, but the introduction to his book, in which he talks about what he means by cultural decadence. And why should the story of culture come to an end? It doesn't, of course, in the literal sense of stoppage or total ruin. All that is meant by decadence is falling off. It implies, in those who live in such a time, no loss of energy or talent or moral sense. On the contrary, it is a very active time, full of deep concerns, but peculiarly restless, for it sees no clear lines of advance. He's talking about the culture, the status quo of culture in our day. The loss it faces is that of possibility. The forms of art, as of life, seem exhausted. The stages of development have been run through. Institutions function painfully. That's a state of crisis. Institutions function painfully. Repetition and frustration are the intolerable result. Boredom and fatigue are great historical forces. Barzun is not the first to declare that our culture is in decline. I remember when I first went to college that they were talking about Oswald Spengler, a German philosopher who said so in The Decline of the West, which was published several times between 1918 and 1928. I was born in 1918. Many others since that time have joined the same chorus. For 100 years at least, philosophers have been saying Western culture is on the downslide, the slippery slope. We're already on it, have been for a long time. Now, if we have a viewpoint such as this, it seems to me that they should bring perhaps a less strident, a less frenzied appraisal of the present scene that is common today. If this is really true, perhaps we should just calm ourselves and take it in stride and take a deep breath and say, well, so what? We can handle that. Despite the evidence that, as Mike Regeli says, the entire world is experiencing social change that is unpredictable, discontinuous, chaotic, and transformative, unequaled perhaps since the 16th century Reformation, most of us tend to approach our situations with a conviction that certain individuals or groups in the local community are ganging up on us and threatening the life of the church. I think a lot of people think this is a temporary fluke. If we can all just get the old folks to die off, we can take over and things will be fine again. I say that a bit seriously. Under God, we are all responsible for our response to life's challenges in whatever period we live. I and mine, you and yours. But if we understand that we are witnessing and participating in a revolution that is unequaled since the 16th century Reformation, which was the dawn in Barzun's 500-year history. For him, this was the dawn of culture. And that all institutions and individuals are involved in the struggle, our thinking may be more reasoned and our emotional reactions more tempered. For one thing, we may show less anger toward the new pastor who has decided that if the church is to grow, he must ignore the wishes of the 60 and older crowd and the bona fide needs of everyone else in order to develop what seems to satisfy the felt needs of a noisy minority in the congregation. Contemporary worship driven by popular music styles, period. If we see that his actions are part of a worldwide cultural decline that is moving inexorably toward either Armageddon or a new Reformation, we may rather direct our anger and our strategies against the principalities and powers that are our true enemies. Incidentally, Marva Dawn uses that phrase extensively. She says that our enemies in the war today are not the people we're fighting against, they are the principalities and powers of the culture. And you identify them as those who oppose God, human and demonic. On the other hand, if we understand that today's cultural aberrations are signaling the rapidly approaching end of Western leadership in the world, like the 4th century fall of the Roman Empire, we may be less convinced that our problem will be solved by such trivialities as electronic toys and consumerist choices in worship. If we really believe it's a serious problem, it will take serious analysis and serious answers. And what does Barzun mean by the forms of art, as of life, seem exhausted? Well, begin with the visual arts that confront pedestrians at Chicago's City Hall and Louisville's Art Center. Incidentally, they moved it back in place. And people go by that and say, what in the world is that? In front of Louisville's Art Center down on Main Street. So-called modern art appeared first in the 19th century as a revolt against the classic ideas of composition and subject matter in visual art. Since that time, modern art has spawned such diverse expressions as Impressionism, I don't know how many of these you recognize, Art Nouveau, Fauvism, Expressionism, Cubism, Futurism, Constructionism, Suprematism, Dadaism, New Objectivity, and Abstract Expressionism, all isms of modern art, all of the 20th century. At the same time, some critics, including theologians like H.R. Ruckmacher, in his book The Modern Art and the Death of a Culture, have argued that these styles constitute more than a century of cultural decline. Before him, Francis Schaeffer, some of you may know that name. Francis Schaeffer was one such culture watcher and culture critic. But his in the area of theology. Now, in my own and your own, those of you who are musicians, in my own discipline of music, I have witnessed in this century the frustration that occurs because music as an art seems to have exhausted its basic elements of melody, harmony, and rhythm. How many times I've heard this in the many years I've been going to school. Scholars have pointed out that music reached a climax in the development of melody in the multi-voiced polyphony of the 15th century Burgundian school and works like the Festmesse for 53 voices, the Missa Salisburgensis, probably written about 1625 A.D., with two choirs of eight parts each and 35 instrumental parts grouped in seven choruses. From that time on, melody was no longer the central feature of composition. Music was said to have exhausted the resources of harmony by the late 19th century, as shown in the music of Richard Wagner, Franz Liszt, Richard Strauss, and others. And finally, music depleted the forces of rhythm, beginning with Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring, 1913, and continuing through much of the 20th century. So during the last 100 years, composers have felt compelled to develop a succession of new resources for music creativity. Having exhausted melody, harmony, and rhythm, what are they to do? Well, we've had such concepts, and you hear more isms now, or istics. They have developed forms as nationalistic or ethnic music based on folk song melodies or rhythms, or literary elements taken from ethnic folklore, impressionistic music emphasizing coloristic sounds more than form, neoclassical music characterized by objectivity and expressive restraint, textural transparency, formal balance, expressionism, atonality, aleatory music, etc., etc. Now, all that to explain the argument that he uses, that the forms of art as of life seem exhausted, and I think you'd find it true of every art that you would study in our day, music, the painting arts, etc., etc. Of course, modern artists would tell you that they have new kinds of creativity, but still the argument continues. We have run out of ideas in our traditional arts. Furthermore, if such decline characterizes the serious arts of the gallery, museum, and concert hall, what can we say about the quality of the more popular arts of motion pictures, television, and pop music, both in and out of the church? I would just ask you, what do you think about the quality of pop art in your day? What do you think about the quality of television pop art, of movie pop art, of secular pop music? What about it in our day? Has it run its course? All of which have received shrill criticism by fairly large groups of concerned citizens. Notwithstanding the fact that I understand very well how hard it is to listen to someone say, "Your generation is in trouble." It's a very difficult thing to understand at your age, because you're here preparing to take it on. And I say power to you. God bless you. It needs taking on. And I pray God will prepare you to do it with all seriousness and with all the tools that you get. Marzahn also notes the dysfunctioning of institutions in the current nadir of Western culture. Without doubt, our most important institutions, what are they? The church, the public school, and the home are functioning painfully these days, exhibiting both boredom and fatigue, and also creating great anxiety. Divorce, the sexual revolution, the legalizing of abortion has shaken the foundation of more than half of our families. To say nothing, what just plain culture does, if it is worshipped as our prevailing culture. In the current political scene, public education is at the top of the crisis agenda. Drugs and guns have invaded the classroom, and curricula have been dumbed down to accommodate the declining achievements of students. The latter has been blamed on too much watching the boob tube, and the dropping of arts and humanities courses from class schedules. The other institution, of course, is our church. Attendance at mainline churches has sagged dramatically in the last 20 years. Further attrition and wholesale schism is now threatened, partly because of fractious disagreement about the morality of abortion and homosexual acts and the integrity of the new worship procedures and music styles. Interesting contrast of issues that are tearing the church apart in our day. In this regard, some readers will ask whether Barzun's earlier statement about morality is realistic. What did he say? That there's no lack of moral sense. If it is true that in our time people have, quote, no loss of moral sense, that is, awareness of morality, it is then patently evident that some individuals judge actions to be moral which others believe are blatantly immoral. And that tends to prove that many individuals have adopted the relativistic philosophy we call postmodernism, even though they would not try to describe what it really means. Jacques Barzun's argument continues. It will be asked, how does the historian know when decadence sets in? How dare I say it's happening already? By the open confessions of malaise, of sickness, by the search in all directions for a new faith or faiths, and that means both secular faiths and religious faiths. Dozens of cults have latterly arisen in the Christian West. Buddhism, Islam, yoga, transcendental meditation, Dr. Moon's Unification Church, and a large collection of others, some dedicated to group suicide. To secular minds, the old ideals look outworn or hopeless, and practical aims are made into creeds sustained by violent acts, fighting nuclear power, global warming, and abortion, saving from use the environment with its fauna and flora, promoting organic against processed foods, and proclaiming disaffection from science and technology. The impulse to primitivism animates all these negatives. Well, interesting, I should remind you, this is written by a secular historian. Barzun may have faith, but he doesn't reveal it, so far as I know, in his book. The information age created by television and computer has quite submerged us in a sea of open confessions of malaise from both qualified and unqualified witnesses. In this context, it is fair to ask whether modern media transmission of the pure Christian gospel can survive the competition of so many pseudo-gospels, both spiritual and aspiritual. Many Christian scholars have maintained that the West's decline began with its dawn, that the first step on the slippery slope was the loss of unity in Christendom. What the 16th century church needed was reform, they say, not the schism and disunity of the Reformation. In recent years, many Christian leaders have worked passionately to regain that Christian unity. But secular minds have countered that the strength of American culture is its plurality of faiths, whether that of Dr. Moon or of the Ecological Sierra Club. When traditional Christianity is put on the defensive by its competition, we should be surprised if its worship expressions were not questioned by both believing and unbelieving minds. But when that appears in a culture which has no faith in tradition, we may well expect that modernity will take over. And I would pause, partly because I understand that this is fairly thick understanding, and I would pause just to say, a culture that has lost faith in tradition is going to throw out historic religion. Historic religion exists by tradition. We have a traditional book. It's pretty ancient. And if you want to be modern, you better get rid of it fast. We have traditional hymns. But if you have no faith in tradition, you really have no faith in Christian religion. Because our God is the God of history. And ours is a faith of tradition. We're celebrating part of that tradition just within the next week. We're celebrating a week that the church has celebrated for 2,000 years. Witness then the almost universal success of the new contemporary worship and its music. Barzan continues to refer to the popular socio-political religions of our day. Such causes serve to concentrate the desire for action in a stalled society. For in every town, country, or nation, it is seen that most of what government sets out to do for the public good is resisted as soon as proposed. Now he's talking about the conflict in political life. And he's laying it at the root of the argument as to which direction we go in our culture. Not two, but three or four groups, organized or impromptu, are ready with contrary reasons as sensible as those behind the project. The upshot is a floating hostility to things as they are. It inspires the repeated use of the dismissive prefixes anti and post, that is, anti-art, postmodernism, and the promise to reinvent this or that institution. The hope is that getting rid of what is will by itself generate the new life. It may be that ours is the angriest generation in recent memory. Government and politics seem to engender more persistent antagonism and more caustic language than that of earlier periods. And the hope seems to be that sophisticated labeling will somehow ameliorate, relieve the tragedies brought on by road rage, airline rage, shopping mall rage, family rage, worship rage, and church music rage, or worship rage. Plain old-fashioned civility seems to be society's lost grace. These are pictures of culture, your culture, mine, in our day. Finally, in evaluating the arguments of Barzan, in the little book True Worship, I say that it is interesting to note that today's creative worship reforms movement is known best for what it has subtracted from worship. It's supposed to be creative, but we know it mostly for what it has left out, not for what it has added. The cover story of the August 1966 issue of the Atlantic Monthly begins with this description of contemporary worship iconoclasm or house cleaning. No spires, no crosses, no robes, no clerical collars, no hard pews, no kneelers, no biblical gobbledygook, no prayerly rote, no fire, no brimstone, no pipe organs, no dreary 18th century hymns. I don't know many dreary hymns of any century. No forced solemnity. No Sunday finery. No collection plates. But the list is too short. The contemporary church has not only lost hymnals and organs, in many instances it has lost the Bible and prayer and anything that resembles authoritative preaching. That's did I say 66? I'm sure it's 96.
I was thinking of Vatican II when you said 66.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be 96. No. Now, let me move on from, and I remember last year when I did deliver this lecture, I got to the end of the first day, and somebody looked around and said, you know, is there no good news in this? Chances are that would be the impression that you have with you as you leave today, because this is the end of the story for today. There'll be just more of it. But there's good news, and if you would hear it, you know, either come back to the next lecture or write me and I'll send you a copy, because I'd be glad to give you the good news as well. I'm trying to paint a picture that needs to be complete. Another picture of early 21st century decadence is given, and this is even more compelling, it seems to me, is given by Morris Berman, who is Jewish, incidentally, in his book, The Twilight of American Culture. Berman is more specific and more personal in his indictments and finds modern and postmodern American commercial materialism to be both the prevailing new faith and the cancer of society. Materialism, for him, is the worst aspect of the new culture. And this, I'm going to have to ask you, I'm sorry, I do have it. And it's better, I think, if you can read it along with me. I do this on purpose. I think you really won't understand it if I just read it. As the 21st century dawns, American culture is, quite simply, in a mess. Millions of Americans feel this, if only on a subliminal level, while a few hundred write books and articles about it, documenting the trends and analyzing the causes. Titles such as Lewis Lapham's Waiting for the Barbarians or Robert Kaplan's An Empire Wilderness increasingly dot our library shelves, and excerpts from these books and articles on these themes find their way into some of the better national magazines. And the arguments they make are not wrong. The documentation that they provide of crumbling school systems and widespread functional illiteracy, of violent crime and gross economic inequality, of apathy, cynicism, and what might be called spiritual death is quite overwhelming. It doesn't take an Einstein or an Emerson to recognize that the system has lost its moorings and, like ancient Rome, is drifting into an increasingly dysfunctional situation. This is culture in our day. Still, we have ways, both individually and culturally, of hiding this from ourselves. There are so many anodynes around, such as the constant outpouring of new technological toys, and the media is brilliantly adept at drowning the country in the kinds of spectacles that keep our minds focused on the trivial and the sensational. O.J. Simpson's trial, Princess Di's death, Bill Clinton's sex life, and the CNN-style infotainment that one media rebel rightly refers to as Muzak. We had Muzak, and then there was Newzak. Berman takes issue with Barzun's contention that today's decaying culture shows no loss of energy, insisting that our much vaunted American energy is shadow rather than substance. In the following quotation, Macworld is a political scientist name for commercial corporate consumerism, for its own sake. Now, this you'll have to just listen to. Check out any TV ad for Nike or Pepsi, and you'll see that Macworld has tremendous vitality. It appears energetic and upbeat. The problem is that since this vitality celebrates nothing substantive beyond buying and owning things, which again is the picture of our culture, which is the objective of our culture, which is the god of our culture, it itself is the cultural decline I am talking about. The following items are gleaned from the book of Mr. Berman, and let me just pick up a few here and there, and then stop and talk with you just a little bit. Of the 158 countries in the United Nations, the United States ranks 49th in literacy. Roughly 60% of the adult population has never read a book of any kind, and only 6% reads as much as one book a year, where a book is defined to include harlequin romances and self-help manuals. Something like 120 million adults are illiterate or read at no better than a fifth grade level. So what's cultural about reading a book? Don't be silly. In 1998, the Massachusetts Board of Education instituted a literacy test for teachers pegged at the level of an exam for a high school equivalency diploma. Of the 1,800 prospective teachers who took it, 59% failed. In response to this, the interim commissioner of education announced that the passing grade would be lowered. It's one solution to the problem of failing the test. Now, of course, this doesn't happen at Southern Seminary. This is just those secular institutions that you didn't go to. You all made the right choice. Writing in Harper's Magazine, Mark Edmondson relates that he typically gets good teaching evaluations from his students because of his classroom persona. Bland, humorous, detached. He reports that an attitude of calm consumer expertise pervades the responses on the evaluation forms, and that the students have a serene belief that his function is to entertain them. The central thrust of our consumer culture, he adds, is buy in order to be, and the culture of the university moves within this new orbit. As a result, the kids are shocked if their college profs don't reflexively suck up to them. The university's relationship with its customers, he says, is nearly servile. The unstated directive from the administration to the faculty is this: teach what pulls the kids in or walk. Now, let me stop a moment to say, you're saying to yourself, it wasn't that way when I went to school. But I dare say that you have a feeling that it was that way some places. And it is that way in some schools, in some classes. And there are a lot of studies which suggest to us that this is part of the culture. We have more people going to university today, or at least starting the university, and then dropping out, than ever in our history. But for the most part, it is not serious education that is sought for. Now, let me just in our closing moments relate what I've just said a bit about to the church. Earlier in Jubilate 2, as in most studies of the current crisis in worship and its music, the immediate spark which ignited the Holocaust is identified as the communications gap between baby boomers and their forebears. As boomer teens, they expressed rebellion against their parents and grandparents, partly in secular rock and roll music. When they came to be adults and were willing to return to church, they insisted on worship music with the same musical characteristics, by and large. We called it contemporary Christian music that was developed by the California Jesus people and their successors. These baby boomers also welcomed the less cognitive, more emotional, and entertaining, stripped-down service structure with praise and worship congregational song that was developed by charismatic Pentecostal leaders and quickly adopted by most evangelicals of the revivalist heritage. Those of us who are accustomed to revivals felt quite at home with praise and worship music. It was simple, it had lots of repetition, it was joyful, it was loud. In this closing chapter, I suggest that this recent history should be seen as part of the larger cultural and spiritual decline described by these historians, Jacques Barzan and Morris Berman, that what has happened in the church is part of the crisis that is a worldwide crisis in culture. And we should identify it as such. And you say to yourself, well, isn't the Holy Spirit doing something remarkable in our day? Yes, maybe. Perhaps, yes. We hope so. We pray so. We may even believe so. But it doesn't change the fact of the declining culture. It hasn't at least yet changed the fact. It could change the fact of the declining culture, but it has not yet. So the tentative answer to is this one of God's terrible springtimes? Well, it's terrible, but I don't think it's springtime. Personally, I don't think it's springtime. In 1995, Marva Dawn, who some of you know and have read her works, a brilliant Lutheran theologian and ethicist, who's written two fine books about worship. Some of us believe that the strength of her argument may be measured by the furor with which her first book was received. Nobody missed her implications with the title, Reaching Out Without Dumbing Down. The implications were clear, that most of today's worship music changes amounted to dumbing down. And the iconoclasts, today's worship leaders, just could not accept that. But why all the fuss? Why should they get all excited about it? Shouldn't they expect it? Since most churchgoers attend the same public schools, colleges, and universities mentioned in previous paragraphs, and since few churches work actively to create an educational, communications, and entertainment counterculture, is it not logical to believe that the dumbed-down secular culture would drag the church down with it? Isn't that to be expected? Besides, many church leaders have argued, and today they too are mostly baby boomers. That is, the ministers are mostly baby boomers. It is important to reach out to the unchurched, even if you must dumb down, or even if you must entertain in order to do so. Now, I'm going to stop and entertain a few moments of questions. I'm going to stop right at that point, and I painted a sketchy picture. But I've reminded you of what you've already heard in other places. You know, this isn't new to you. You've heard little inklings of this here and there. You've heard us older generation, you know, gnashing our teeth, and you've dismissed it perhaps as senility, and it could be partly senility. I keep asking myself every morning as I wake up. But I'm wondering if any of you have any words to contribute at this rather difficult spot in the argument.
This lecture continues this Thursday at 2:30.
That's right.
That's part two of this one. And for those of you that are outside of these classes, a different lecture to the Worshiping Church class will be at 12:30 on this Thursday and the following Tuesday. Asking about the reality of worshiping the God of creation and redemption, a package of those two things.
Incidentally, the two groups of lectures are tied, and I will say that somewhere on Thursday. There's a tie between the two, and I think that our failure in this regard, our failure to offer a counterculture, comes from our failure to worship the God of creation properly. That God has given us a revelation which we call natural revelation, and most of us pay little attention to what God has revealed in natural revelation. God has a will for secular culture, and certainly has a will for ordinary culture in the church. God cares what books you read, what movies you watch, how you spend your money. God cares. And you say, that's my choice. No, I'm sorry. That's not your choice. God cares about that. And that's why I dare to challenge you, even with a kind of a, you know, two before across the eyes. You know what the two before means now. Question or comment? Speak up so that most people.
I cannot remember. I can't think of any dreary hymns.
a church that basically only had contemporary music. I don't want to hear one of those hymns. This isn't a funeral. And I thought about that a lot, as one who loves hymnody. And I have, I guess my thought in all this, and I'll just ask for your comment and response, is that there is a whole generation of churchgoers who grew up in more traditional churches who found it to be not very meaningful. And I'm not talking about people who are very culturally educated. I'm talking about your basic pop consumer in this country. And they all reacted, or many of them reacted against that, and now,
no.
If they're in church, we find them in
no.
the contemporary church, in praise
no.
and worship, and they're very comfortable
no.
with that. And I don't know where to take that.
Let's begin with the argument. I don't blame the baby boomers. I don't blame the baby boomers for the decision that they make. They had lots of reasons to reject the historic cultural church. But I don't oppose the music which they espouse. In fact, I insist that all churches should have contemporary music, including the best examples of contemporary pop music. All churches must have contemporary pop music as part of what they use, but only as a responsible part of what they use. I think there's lots of blame to be dished around in many places. But the question is, how do we work our way out of this mess? And my answer is, we don't do it by throwing out everything. In fact, we're throwing out the church when we throw out its hymns. The hymns are the church. They are part of the church identity. And historically, worship has always treasured. What's the oldest Christian hymn I can sing? Oh, let me see, be sure to sing the oldest Christian hymn I can sing. Why? Well, that reminds me that the Holy Spirit's been here a while. And if I can sing a hymn of the second century, I'm shaking hands and embracing the Christians of the second century A.D. And we must sing historic hymns because we are a historic faith. God's a God of history. We must. Ours, it's a story we tell. And if you throw out the whole story, you've got no religion.